Hello, and welcome to ContraPulse. This is Julie Vallemont. Today, we speak with Arthur Davis. Arthur has been involved in the contra dance scene since an early age and has been actively playing for dances as a piano player since he was a teenager. He also plays banjo, trumpet, button accordion, and concertina with, in his words, varying degrees of competence. Arthur has played with the bands Gallimaufry, Cloud 10, and Hidden Drive with Andy Davis and Lori Indenbaum, as well as playing with whoever happens to show up to play tunes. In other parts of his life, he has spent a number of years working on tall ships with students of all ages, integrating music and singing into the life of a working sailing vessel. He currently lives in Brattleboro, Vermont, where he runs a community-scale urine recycling program. Arthur and I had a lovely chat on a beautiful summer night on my porch. We talked about his early roots, building communities through dance, and glorious New England tunes. And as piano players, we also had a real piano player geek out session. We talked about piano styles, the difference between acoustic pianos and keyboards, and the fact that many dance halls don't have real pianos anymore, and what that means. As always, we're wearing masks, so apologies if it sounds a little muffled. The music you're hearing is a home recording of three classic tunes that Arthur recently made with his father, Andy Davis, on accordion. Hope you enjoy the interview.
It's good to see you.
Arthur Davis, welcome to ContraPulse.
Thank you. It's great to be here on your porch.
Yes, my porch is the new hot spot, but one at a time, people.
Not that kind of hot spot.
It is a wireless hot spot.
Right.
So we're just here to chat about contra dancing. I found the last couple interviews, it takes us a few minutes to warm up because we have to remember like what this thing is.
Well, I was thinking about that today because I was thinking about coming this evening, but I was just trying to remember the experience of being at a contra dance, which seems like it was a long time ago.
I know.
And like things that that have been on my mind in the past about contra dancing and contra dance music that I just haven't thought about in a long time. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see how the memory goes.
What we've found so far is that it's like riding a bicycle.
Yeah.
You forget and you're a little wobbly first and then it's right. Like, oh, right, we remembered this.
Yeah.
Like, you have probably been playing for conscious for a very long time, like most of your life, right?
I have. So my first memory of playing contra dance music was my dad had a kids contra dance band. It was through the Brattleboro Music Center, I think, or it might have not been. I think it wasn't actually. I think it was just a thing that my dad did. I'm not sure, to be honest. But we met at the Oak Grove School right down the road, and I played recorder mostly in the band.
Wow, how old were you playing recorder?
Like second or third grade, I think, is when this maybe started. And we had, like, we'd practice for, like, you know, the fall, and then we'd play at one of my dad's family dances up in Dummerston, and then we'd also we also had a kitchen junket at our house, so like all of the families would come and we'd like move all the furniture and have a little dance and all the kids would play.
Wow.
It was very fun.
And just for context for our listeners, your father happens to be Andy Davis.
Indeed.
Well-known yes. pianist and an accordionist and singer.
Yeah.
And yeah. he's been in the Brattleboro scene for a long time.
That's true. Yeah, since sometime in the 80s, I guess.
And you grew up having these kitchen junkets and playing recorder. That is so much fun.
It was very fun. So then I started playing piano. I started taking classical piano lessons at some point also in elementary school. And then I started I learned most of the country dance piano that I at least learned from the beginning stages of that part of my piano playing from my dad. And I would say that he's probably the biggest influence on my playing, but that has definitely evolved over the years. Or who's maybe the first influence on my playing.
Right.
And it's evolved since then, but I would say that it I'm still trying to achieve many of the aspects of his playing that I like that I can't do.
The lifelong quest.
Oh yeah, for sure.
What is his playing style based in, and how does that compare to yours?
One of the things that he does that I really enjoy that I that I have never quite mastered is a lot of inside lines. So I think he thinks about things. He studied a lot of Baroque music when he was younger. He's talked to me sometimes about how that influenced his, like, the way that he thinks about, like, chords and, like, going from one, you know, thing to the next. And I think he, and especially how the chords relate to the melody. And I think that he's definitely more so than many players today. There's, I think he really tries to tailor the chords, make the chord choices that he's making have a direct link to the melody,
mm-hmm.
which is, not necessarily a good choice or a bad choice,
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely, I think, a lot of times these days, I think that a lot of people play a chord progression kind of for the sake of the chord progression.
Right.
Or at least that it seems like that happens more. I've heard that more recently.
The tune becomes a foil that you can put your cool chords over.
Right, exactly. And I think that my earliest influence was definitely kind of the opposite direction of, like, tailoring the chords to the melody. And if the melody, is playing this arpeggio, then that's the kind of the chord that he would use. But he uses a lot of inside, I call them inside lines. Let's see if I can try to describe what that means. I think of it as like a lot of, like, thirds and sixths,
mm-hmm.
that kind of, you know, weave in chromatic ways, and uses a lot of chromatic leading lines from one thing to the next, often a lot of circle of fifths kinds of things.
And you're gesturing with your thumbs as you do that. Is something that you do with your thumbs. Does that have its origins in Quebec piano playing?
Yeah.
Or
at least is, I think, a big part of a lot of Quebec
mm-hmm.
piano playing that I've heard.
Yeah.
And I think he definitely also had a lot of influence from folks that he met up there. So.
Mm-hmm. And so where does that lead you to your style now? I mean, we can jump all around in this interview from your early days to now. We just skipped your whole life, basically.
That's good. No, that's
we'll
good.
Go back to the middle later.
When I think about, like, my role as a piano player in playing for contra dances, I think of myself primarily as the rhythm section, And I think, I was, I think one lesson that I kind of got from my early days of playing country dance piano was that, that whatever choices you make in terms of the notes, that's less important than keeping the rhythm going, mm-hmm. and being a stable place where, you know, the people who are on the dance floor moving around can, you know that, you know, they have a steady foundation of beat to
right.
walk around to. So I think that, you know, some, I don't know. I think that, in contrast to a lot of piano playing and also piano playing that I do, depending on the context, I find my piano playing changes a lot when I'm playing with someone else who is also filling that role of kind of like the main rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I'm playing with a guitar player or something like that. And I enjoy that, but I think what I really love doing is getting to be that person who's kind of in the rhythmic driver's seat.
Mm-hmm.
I think it brings out a different kind of playing that I don't know. I'm hesitant to say I enjoy it more, but, it's something that, feels special in a different kind of way,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the music.
You certainly have the most freedom if you're the only rhythm player.
Totally.
Chordally and rhythmically.
Right.
And you don't have to coordinate with anybody else.
Right. I think I enjoy not having to coordinate on such an intense level all the time.
Well, it's funny because it's not only do you not have to coordinate with someone else, but I also feel like you don't have to coordinate with yourself. Like your brain
For
doesn't
sure.
have to know what it's going to do before you do it. Your hands and your subconscious can have their
they
own whims.
They just kind of move.
Yeah.
You may experience that too.
Yeah, totally.
It's very weird because I do things that I'm like, I have no idea why I did that or where did that come from?
Yeah, totally. How many times have I told myself that? Why did I do that? I don't know.
Where did it come from? Like, have I ever done that before?
I mean, I guess that's what they call inspiration, right? That's
I guess.
The closest we get to it most days.
Right. It feels like a fairly mundane inspiration, but I suppose inspiration all the same. Right. So, but I also, like, I think that, when it really comes down to it, I just really love listening to the tunes. And, you know, I'm someone who has dabbled in melody instruments for, you know, different melody instruments for my whole life.
Besides the recorder.
Right now I'm semi-working on playing the concertina, which is quite fun. But I've never really achieved proficiency enough on a melody instrument where I can, you know, just have a vast swath of tunes that I can just like play for dances. Mm-hmm. And but one thing that I really have enjoyed about playing the piano for country dancing for so many years is that I just know, like, I can sing all of these tunes.
Mm-hmm.
I know them all in my mm-hmm. head. I can't necessarily play them on a melody instrument, but
right.
I can sing them all.
Right.
And
I mean, you play banjo and accordion and some other things, but there's a certain facility that you need at a concert dance. I mean,
totally. Yeah, yeah.
When we were together at Pinewoods that year, when we were in the band with Ethan Hazard Watkins, we had some great morning banjo for
it's
those
true.
Morning dances.
That was very fun.
It's great. But yeah, it's sort of like that joke, like if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, doesn't make a sound. It's like if the piano player knows the tune but can't play it, is it still a tune? You know, like I feel like we rhythm players have all these tunes. Like I must know, I don't know, hundreds of tunes. I don't even know how many I know. I don't keep a tune list like melody players do.
Right.
But But what they're in there, how do you get them out?
Right.
It's funny.
You know, I think another just an interesting thing that I've come across, like as a backup accompaniment player, I think often I've been in situations where, you know, people are really, if I'm playing with a melody player who I haven't played with before, sometimes folks are really, you know, wanting to like rehearse and you know, like make sure that we know the same tunes. And I often more so enjoy just going and, you know, learning, you know, figuring out what tunes we know in common in the moment and, you know, figuring out, getting the opportunity to kind of learn them on the fly. And I don't know, I think that was a thing that was uncomfortable for me for many years, but, was something that I think, you know, part of the like kind of, you're the rhythm section, you can, you know, make, you know, take a, you know, the number one job is being the rhythm section,
mm-hmm.
and taking a few times to, you know, figure it out on the fly. It definitely, I feel like it's a skill that you get better at over time.
Like when someone's playing a tune that you don't know,
right.
And all of a sudden you have to put chords behind it.
Right.
Often you have to play potatoes and you don't know what's coming next.
Exactly.
And the one chord is usually a good starting
a good
point, but not
start.
Always.
It ain't always a good place to start.
It's not always a good place to end even.
Right. So that's always, those are fun moments.
And it is a skill to listen to a tune as it goes by, an unfamiliar tune, to try to get its essence quickly, chordally.
Right.
Like to put a rough structure in place and then fill it in as...
Over time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How do you think, like, when did that skill come together for you?
I think it was, I mean, I think, I'm trying to remember. I feel like at that, there was a point in my life I was playing a lot with my dad and Lori Indenbaum, who's a fiddler who lives up in Athens, Vermont. And I think it was kind of something where we were playing quite a lot together, and you know, we play a lot of the same tunes, but then we would kind of play new tune, we'd throw in new tunes as, you know, some new tunes every time. And I think it was kind of a gradual process of getting more comfortable with that. I think it was also something that my dad encouraged me to work on, because I was kind of afraid of doing that. And I, you know, wanted to do the right thing,
mm-hmm.
but kind of getting more comfortable with, like, just kind of, you know, not necessarily doing it the correct way the first time, but...
Meaning the chords matching the tune,
right.
Correctly?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you've also got dancers to think about.
Exactly.
As well.
Right. You know, I think also a big part of my playing from, you know, in terms of where... the kinds of dances that I played for a lot when I was learning to play were more community dances rather
mm-hmm.
than like, you know, the contra dance circuit kind of dances.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of, both as a musician and as a kind of just person in the contra dance community, I think that has definitely shaped my a lot of things about how I think about social dancing. In terms of the music, you know, the idea that, like, you know, we're kind of there to, you know, help facilitate them having a good time together. And you know, just like, and being very steady is kind of the number one job.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else kind of can come after, flow from that.
So rhythmically steady,
yeah.
And probably chordally steady.
Yeah.
Whatever that means.
Whatever
do you,
that means.
Do you tend to be whatever predictable? Like the way, will you chord a tune the same way a lot of times in a row, or is it kind of different every time through? Or
I would say similar, but I mean, I think that when I'm like playing a tune a lot of times in a row, often I make different. I'm often making the same chord choices a lot of times in a row, but making different kind of ways of approaching it, both in terms of either dynamics or in terms of you know choppy or more smooth, mm-hmm. or the way that I'm getting from one chord to the next chord.
Right. Walk ups, walk downs.
Yeah.
That kind of chromatic
leading
thing you're talking
about.
I'm
very big fan of the chromatic things in general.
I mean, I love your piano playing. It's got this wonderful, like, old school charm to it that I think, I don't know, maybe that comes across the wrong way, but it's great.
Well, like, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Like, it's like whimsical and clearly a spur of the moment sometimes, which is really fun because I don't always know what you're going to do. But then...
I don't either.
But then it's got that older sound, more... what is tradition? I'm trying to avoid using the word tradition to define anything.
Sure.
But right, using right. things to define the word tradition instead. But it's got a different sound that we don't always hear in a modern... way.
Right. I mean, I think when I think of a lot of
classic, maybe.
Sure. Right. Like 30, 40 years old.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's the thing. Like, what is tradition? Right. And when are you?
Right.
When are you talking about?
Right. I mean, I think a lot of piano playing that I hear for dances these days, often I feel like piano is used in contra dancing these days. Not exclusively, but very often as along with another rhythm instrument, like as I was mentioning earlier. And I think that it can become, in those situations, much more of a kind of color intermediary kind of instrument in the mix,
yeah.
which is really neat. I don't necessarily think that I'm super good at that. but I, you know, I maybe haven't practiced it as much.
I mean, for years you've played in the band Gallimaufry.
Yeah, I was kind of forced into doing that kind of stuff sometimes.
And that's with Ness on drums.
And sometimes Donald on guitar, yep. or Alex on guitar,
yep.
or cello.
Yep, and someone on foot percussion.
We were always all bunched up in each other's space.
Yeah.
We were also in college, so we were... I don't know what that says, but
right.
we were like, we were excited to be playing together. And, you know, sometimes our instrumentation would kind of like we would get in each other's way for sure.
Yeah.
You know, that was the challenge that, you know, I think we got better at over the years, but it was definitely not always a smooth experience.
Right.
People saying like, you know, I need more space to, like, sometimes, you know, and, you know, from we all, you know, just playing with four other people,
it can
be, there's a lot of noise happening.
Four different brains, four different sets of whims.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, we could talk for a whole hour about just the dynamics of that, which would be...
It'd be pretty fun.
Really fun. You know, like, there's a lot of, I think, people who... don't make music and maybe dance to country music aren't always aware of what it goes into making a band and how bands make decisions or whether they make decisions
right.
about how they're going to play what they play. And usually you either have to have arrangements that you play, have systems that you've worked out in advance for how to decide how to carve out space for each other.
Right.
Get a mind meld after playing together for a long time, if you're lucky.
Right.
Or not care.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and I think we were, you know, we had some things that we did where we kind of like really like planned out certain sections of things. We're like, this is what we're going to do, like, you know, the last bunch of times or something. Mm-hmm. But in general, I think we were largely unplanned. We at a certain point we were like, we should do more planning. But a lot of things were fairly unplanned, but we tried to set up systems, as you were saying, to try to, like, on this one, you know, Donald's going to like kind of take it for a while on the cello, and then, you know, I'm going to maybe sit back for a while.
Exactly. Taking turns driving, as I call it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you can kind of follow each other. Some people yell chords. I'm not a chord yeller.
No, me neither.
I can't say it before I do it. I don't know what my hands are going to do.
Right. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, do you think that how you would do that would depend? Like, do you play differently depending on the audience that you're playing for? Like a community dance versus a big contra dance?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, I think I play differently depending on who I'm playing with, too. Mm-hmm. And like what kinds of tunes we're playing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I think I play differently if I'm playing, say, with you know, with Lori and my dad, and we play a lot of tunes that are, you know, much more kind of New England and Quebec tunes.
Mm-hmm. Lori has this wonderful repertoire of New England tunes.
I her repertoire, you know. For all of the people who I play with, I have to say, I love her fiddle repertoire just about. In terms of, like, tunes that I find myself singing, or, like, I can just, like, sing all the tunes in the repertoire, I love those tunes.
Can you name a couple examples off the top of your head?
Like Bouchard's Hornpipe, and St. Lawrence Jig, and Swinging on a Gate, and now I can't remember the name of this one, but
you can sing it.
Yeah. No, I can't think of it either.
Yeah, I know, right? That's the thing about being a piano player.
Yeah. But anyway, I think I play differently for those, like, if it's like, you know, just like melody players playing those kinds of tunes. And I think I play much more maybe what you would call a kind of, like, I don't know, classic or contra dance piano, like people say boom chuck kind of piano, which is definitely my kind of my bread and butter kind of stuff. But I think if I'm playing with, you know, with a I think often more with, like, when people have a, like, repertoire of a lot of really smooth kinds of tunes, I do other things, which you know, to kind of try to not make my piano playing so kind of chunky and bouncy, along with, like, really smooth Irish tunes or something like that.
What piano styles or inspirations do you draw on?
For those?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Or did you just make it up?
I think I just kind
of
made up stuff that seemed to work, and it's evolved from there.
How do your hands move differently?
More things at the same, like, hands at the same time.
Yeah.
As opposed to back and forth between my left and my right hand. And probably more a sustain pedal, and more like just like holding, like sustain both with the pedal and with my hands.
Right. So it's a kind of dronier, blockier sound.
Yeah. Yeah. But I, you know, I also, I'm trying to balance that at the same time with, you know, trying to keep a rhythm going for the dancers too.
Right, so. You can't get too drony.
No,
or else you lose that rhythm.
Right. And I you know, I kind of think that that's a, like, that's a pretty intrinsic thing for me. And is playing that role. So.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about, like, your dad's repertoire and Laurie's repertoire. Where does most of your dad's repertoire come from? And is that yours, or is your repertoire different now?
Well, as you were saying earlier, it's funny as an accompanist because, like, what is my repertoire? In some ways, my repertoire is whatever the person's repertoire is who I'm playing with.
Right, right.
So
where's your happy place?
Right. I think, like the things that I come back to again and again are, like, the kind of, like, New England and Quebec,
mm-hmm.
and, like, kind of a maritime, you know, like Cape Breton kind of tunes,
mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know, to me, like, I think people have all kinds of adjectives to describe stuff, so I don't really know the right adjectives to describe them, but, like, I think they're, like, a lot more major tunes,
mm-hmm.
And I, in general, like playing major tunes. I like backing up major tunes, I think, better.
Mm-hmm.
I think I feel more free in terms of, like, chordal choices.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if I'm playing lots of minor tunes, then it feels like I'm kind of just playing two chords. And other chords are just feel kind of like too novelty. If you overuse them, it feels like too much of a novelty.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, when it's, like, major tunes that are based on, like, a circle of fifths kind of thing, I feel very free in terms of, like, what I can do and, like, how to move around the piano.
Yep.
And I think that there are plenty of people who I love how they accompany minor tunes, and it's, like, super awesome. But it's definitely my happy place, so to speak, tends to be in that. But I think also, a lot of those tunes I would consider, like, very melody driven tunes, where the melody is like clearly driving the chords as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah.
Which I really like that.
I do too. I love that
dynamic.
And we were talking about, like, how to choose chords, especially in a band situation. But these New England tunes, a lot of these classic tunes, they tell you what chords go with the tune.
Right.
They're just the chords. You don't have to think about it.
You don't have to think about them. And in some ways, like, I often, just in life, music aside, I often feel this way, that I'm more creative when I have constraints.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes when I'm, like, given a blank, totally blank slate of, like, I could do anything in any situation in life, I don't quite know where to start. But if there's a limit of the scope somehow, which could be, like, the melody is telling you basically the chords to play, then I feel a lot more free in terms of what I can do within that constraint.
Limitations are freedom.
Yeah.
Look at haiku or bluegrass.
Totally.
Or contra piano playing.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I really like going to restaurants that have a very limited menu.
Uh-huh.
You know, because then I feel like I'm not overwhelmed by the potential choices.
It means you get to eat at some point that
night.
And
I feel as satisfied, if not more satisfied.
Right.
Usually.
Or even, like, when you go to those restaurants more often in Europe, where they just have a menu and you walk in and that's what they're serving today, and it's a multi-course thing. Tonight, here's what it is. That's a good New England tune, right?
Right, exactly.
It's like, it's here's the one, here's the four, here's the five, here's the one. In the B part, you might get a 5 of 5, but it has to be the 5 of 5 because no other chord will work there.
Right, because there's that one note. It's going to be nothing else.
You know, I played for contra dances for a few years before I started teaching piano,
uh-huh.
you know, as one should. And I remember the first year I was at Maine Fiddle Camp,
uh-huh.
And one night I was on staff teaching piano, and they asked me to play for Dudley's for the evening dance under the tent. And there's like, it's an open band. There's like 30 people on stage. Sure. And Corey DeMario was playing bass. Corey's great. And I didn't know him that well. And it's funny how deep the training is of like, I found myself sitting there thinking, are my chords cool enough? And then I turned to Corey. I was so naive, you know. I turned to Corey and I said, do you want me to do chord subs or anything? And he's like, why? Like, he just looked at me like totally calm. And he's like, why? And I was like, do you get bored playing? And he's like, no, I love it. Like, you just play the tune and you don't worry about what the chords are. And I mean, this was years ago for me now. But I think sometimes as rhythm players, we get used to thinking we have to do cool things.
Sure, right, right, right.
And they're not always the things. I'm sorry, nice. Everybody.
That was awesome.
I'm laughing because you can definitely tell the passing seasons by the sounds that are on these interviews.
For sure.
A couple months ago, it was mating birds, and now it is lawn sprinklers
and dog owners.
Other people's conversations through their open windows and dogs who are out for walks.
Yeah.
So funny. In the fall, it'll be the crinkling of leaves.
Yep.
In the winter, it'll be our soft tears in the snow.
And our chattering teeth because we're still out on the porch.
Yeah. Anyway, I felt like Corey was so accomplished, and I was so grateful to him for just saying, why do we have to change the chords?
Right.
You play the chords the same way every time, and then when you switch tunes, then you play different chords.
Right.
What a gift that was.
Yeah, totally. I also find it's like in those moments, those are the moments when I really can just, I'm just totally in the tune and in the feel, and it just like is totally kicking.
Yeah, you know? And then you can focus on the groove of the tune.
Totally.
When we're thinking about chords, then it means we're busy not thinking about other things.
Right, right.
Or if we're thinking at all, you know, and so that was, I love these New England tunes that they just have a way they go, and why do you have to dress them up, you know?
Yeah.
You can, but you don't have to.
And it's, right.
So, do you have any like defining moments as a dance musician of like moments that you just felt were really cool, either as a dancer or on stage that you remember?
Yeah. Well, I have, I think that, I don't really remember where this was or really when it was, which maybe defeats the purpose of a memory as you were asking me to do, but, but I kind of remember the feeling of like the, when I was like first playing for contra dances on the piano. And the feeling of like being the one person, you know, accompanying the tune, you know, and kind of experiencing it from that perspective. And just it was very like very satisfying experience as a young person.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of, I don't know, feel like, as you were saying, kind of in the driver's seat of the whole kind of experience. Laying the foundation for you know what is kind of happening sonically, and so I remember that feeling of just like really set deep satisfaction of kind of getting to be in that role, so that's something that I continue to feel. But let's see, any specific moments. I have a lot of memories of just being in different interesting places, in the kinds of dances and communities that were kind of that were out dancing. One is up at Castleton what used to be Castleton State College and is now Castleton University in Vermont. And it was a gig that my dad often had at the Governor's Institute of Vermont, the arts program up there. And for many years, I went up just as a little kid playing, not playing in the band, but just going up and tagging along.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just like this big field and like all high school kids in this big field, you know, on a summer night, not unlike tonight. You know, many of whom had never contradanced before, and, you know, but it was kind of, that was kind of the function, or the, that was kind of the means that they were using to build community. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't necessarily they weren't contradancing in order to, you know, do lots of cool contradance moves or even to do cool dances with cool choreography. Mm-hmm. It was really like the function was to like build community among these people who were, you know, getting together for, you know, basically a kind of a summer arts camp. And that really sticks with me as a way to think about social dancing and contra dancing as a, you know, a way to build community amongst people. And it doesn't always have to be the most complicated dances or the, or even executed particularly well, mm-hmm. to like really, you know, be a way of one of many ways to build trust and kind of have fun amongst humans.
Mm-hmm.
So another event that we often did, that I often played for, was up at the Dummerston Grange in Dummerston, Vermont, and it was for the Putney School summer program. So another kind of, you know, bunch of high school kids who are kind of at a summer camp. But that one was amazing because, you know, we'd get there early to play, and we'd set up all, you know, the sound system, and we'd, you know, do our sound check, and then we would just wait. And we knew that, like, they were going to come sometime within, like, around 7 or something. I don't know what time it was, but like, they would almost never get there right at 7. But then at a certain, like, so we'd just be sitting there waiting. And then it was, like, just, you know, like, you know, three of us up on stage, you know. One I often did with Lori and my dad. And then all of a sudden the school bus would pull outside. And in the span of about 15 seconds, the hall went from, like, just the three of us, totally empty hall, to, like, full of crazy high school kid energy.
Wow.
And, like, and then it was, like, off the walls. And then it was, like, immediately, you know, we'd be into, like, you know, playing. And, like, you know, all these kids who had, you know, again, many of them had never done anything like this before. And it was, like, super high energy for, like, you know, an hour and a half. And then the leader of the camp, actually Tom Howe, who is Steve Howe's brother of CDSS, Tom would be like, all right, we're done, back to the buses. And then also in a span of about 15 seconds, the place would just empty. And then it would be back to the three of us just sitting up there in silence.
Like, sort of, what just happened?
What just happened? Was that a dream? Like, what? I'm not quite sure what happened. I think I just woke up. Very funny. Those were very, very exciting dances. But then, you know, also, I have, like, on the kind of more of the, in my travels, like playing for the contradance circuit, so to speak. You know, I remember one really great memory is of the contradance up in Belfast, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, on the same note, it was like just this moment of really almost for the first time, like really seeing a wedding of like the kind of the evening contradance world and the community dance world in like such an amazingly like together way. There's a like the way that they integrate those all those pieces up there is just so special, and I've held that in my heart for all the years since I first played up there.
And have you played there with Cloud 10 or Gallimafri, or who do you play there with?
I think with Cloud 10. But it's really fun because they have this big open band for the like kind of family community dance beforehand.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to go down and like bring my trumpet or something and just like kind of toot along.
Yeah, I didn't even mention the trumpet before when we were talking about instruments.
That's a whole nother thing. That's a whole other thing that's kind of funky to figure out how to play for contra dance.
Right? It's just a hard instrument.
It's a hard instrument.
You're not really set up for fiddle tunes, but no. You make it work.
I always like to play, this is a good trivia if anyone knows this tune who's listening to the podcast, Mountain Ranger.
I love that tune.
It's like one of the only tunes, like old tunes in B-flat. Like there's not a lot there's not a lot of tunes in B-flat in general, but.
And you know what? The people of Belfast in that scene would love the tune Mountain Ranger.
Yeah,
I learned it from Benjamin Foss, who loves to collect old New England tunes. And he now lives in Belfast.
Nice. Hey.
And that community's got a little magic to it. They love the old-fashioned tunes up there.
Yeah.
And I love playing them up there. Mountain Ranger is a great tune.
But that's like one of the only... I was like, there was a time when I was like, I should learn to play a bunch of reels on the trumpet. I don't know why I thought that, but I learned that one. It's the only one that I can like really, it was a funny choice because it's really notey. But I was like, well, it's in B flat, so of course I should learn this one. It'd be really easy.
You should do a medley, Mountain Ranger and a President Garfield's hornpipe.
Yeah.
Call it the Death by Trumpet medley.
It's kind of it's a mouthful to play that by yourself, though. it's like
mouthful.
The only melody instrument. I've done that a couple times, and it's very difficult.
Well, maybe you have to do what they do with bombards in Brittany and, like, tile yourself. You have to have two trumpets.
Play two A's and then, like, call it quits for a few times through.
Exactly. Right.
I've employed that strategy before. Usually when I know that I have like ample backup of other melody players.
Right, you're like, don't leave me alone too long.
Right. Come back in. Or just stop playing and then they kind of figure out, oh, Arthur stopped, I gotta come back in.
Right. Oh, I love the Belfast dance. I mean, I think that to me is a great example of a good combination between that community spirit and contra dancing, you know. It's like it's a dance where people know how to contra dance, but you don't have to know how to contra dance to be welcome.
Yeah.
And
I strive for that feeling in, you know, in wherever I am dancing or playing, for sure.
Yeah. Do you think the different kinds of music lend themselves differently to creating that atmosphere?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I mean, I think... I probably have a very subjective answer to that. So I just preface everything I'm going to say by saying that people could probably have a very valid disagree with me, and that's great. But I think, I don't know, there's something... To me, there is something about, like having the music be like very happy sounding as opposed to kind of like intense, that I think at least having that kind of music at least, you know, come back again and again throughout the evening, that does like really just bring that kind of atmosphere, or like foster help foster that kind of atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. That's an interesting question. I haven't given that specific question a lot of thought. I'm just hypothesizing out of my mouth.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it's something I've been mulling over.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a relationship between the bands and the dancers, and
yeah,
like sometimes I feel like as musicians we play what the dancers want,
right?
But sometimes the dancers respond to what we're playing and they dance differently.
Yeah.
But I just noticed passively, people at NEFA dance differently to like the NEFA Festival Orchestra than they do to some of the other bands. Like the mood seems different in the room.
Yeah.
And at NEFA, because it's a festival, it could be that some people only come for the festival orchestra and not for the other things. So are they dancing differently, or is it different people
in the hall?
But it seems to attract a different vibe. Or maybe because it's the end of the festival and it's like we all finished it. We're all here together. We're all exhausted. I think dancing exhausted can be really great. Like, I love Sundays at the end of a dance weekend. Everyone's like left the outside world behind and their body's been broken down and they're all like doing their last bit of energy.
Yeah, it often feels like, right, just the high percentage of joy in the like percentage of feelings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That exhausted communal joy feeling.
Right.
I think there's something. I don't want to talk too long because this is your interview. But again, this is all highly subjective. That's the magic of this format, is that I could ask everybody the same question. Everyone answers differently and all their answers are right because we all have different experiences within this tradition.
Yeah.
And we all see different corners of the tradition.
Definitely.
But I kind of think that some tunes ask a lot of you as a dancer, or the way we play tunes, it like demands a lot of the dancers.
Right.
And other tunes are just this happy groove, and just like they don't ask us to think of cool chords to put under them, they don't ask the dancers to do fancy moves.
Right. I think one example I think about is that often, you know, just as an example, because I was thinking about it, like at those, you know, high school camp dances up in Dummerston, where, you know, all the kids would come in and what would we do first? But we'd play a tune, like, no, you know, no calling, just like everyone's coming in the hall all at the same time. And we're just going to play. And we, you know, I don't know, we play something like the March of St. Timothy or something, where it's just kind of like, I don't know. I feel like the mood of that tune is just like unfiltered kind of lightheartedness. And I don't know. I think that I don't necessarily think that every tune needs to be that way, but I think that those kinds of tunes and that kind of vibe really does like foster a like we're here to you know, be with each other and in kind of a big sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that matters. You
know, yeah. So I love that feeling. I definitely get lost in that mood in those moments, which is a very natural high.
Does your family play a lot of Bob McQuillan tunes?
Some, for sure. Lori plays a bunch of Bob McQuillan tunes. Lori did a lot of work with Bob in terms of publishing quite a number of publications of his tunes, I believe. And so she plays a number of Bob McQuillan tunes. I do have a very distinct memory of being very little and walking into the Peterborough townhouse. Is that what it's called? They call it the Peterborough
Town Hall.
Town Hall, yeah. And as a quite little person and hearing Bob play the piano, and it was definitely a force of nature, you know, there was no doubt of who was driving the bus.
Right.
And I there are moments when I try to channel that as best I can.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a very unique, very like downward play style of playing, like a lot of you could sink into it with your feet, like
totally.
You know, very sturdy.
Very sturdy.
Sturdy playing.
Which, you know, I think, you know, when I think about contra dancing, like all traditions, has evolved a ton, which is like both is like inevitable and also necessary. It's interesting to see how it evolves differently in different places. And as someone who has like continued, who lives in a place where it has, been around for a long time, there is a kind of like a, I don't know, when I go to some of the like dances that have been around for a long time, there's definitely a kind of I don't know quite what I'm saying, but there is a sturdiness to dancing in a, I don't know if it's an older style.
Yeah, a couple things
that fits with that style of playing, for sure.
Yeah, and we've kind of tangentially touched on this in some of these interviews, but we haven't explored it a lot, is playing with a sound system versus without a sound system.
Oh, sure,
and
yeah.
And how that affects the way you play. Have you done gigs without a sound system?
Yeah, before? Yeah. I love playing for gigs where the piano is just not quite in tune.
Wet tuning.
You know, as a piano player, because in those situations, if you don't have a sound system, it means you're playing a real piano.
Right.
In almost all cases, I suppose. And you're kind of at the mercy of whatever the instrument or instrument-shaped object that's there.
Right.
And, but it is not necessarily always like the most sonically satisfying in the kind of tunefulness way. There's another piece of that that's like kind of, that is also kind of satisfying. But I do like playing that in that way, where I don't know, in some ways it's like we were talking about earlier with the constraints.
Mm-hmm.
By having constraints of like, you now there's even more constraint where you have to play so that everyone can hear you.
Right.
And it's like kind of up to you to do that. It kind of frees you from some of the other things that you might feel like you have to do. And as a dancer, I feel like also when I've been in those situations, it frees you from like wanting to hear lots of different things, because there's just kind of an excitement of, here we are, there's like nothing. You know, it's just the sound that's being produced and us listening to it and responding to it. I don't know if you've had gigs where the power has gone out partway through.
Those are my favorite gigs ever.
They're so
it's
good.
It's magical every time.
I remember one time Gallimaufry was playing. So luckily with Gallimaufry, there's five of us, so we can produce a lot of sound.
Right.
But we were playing at Glen Echo.
And that's a big hall.
The power went out, and it's so cavernous in there. And we all like sat on the edge of the stage, you know. And you know, Donald had the cello. That we like put up the piano, the lid on the piano, and just tried to play so that everyone could hear us. And it's a lot of things that maybe we worked on as a band kind of went out the window in those moments. But it's still an experience that we all remember way more vividly than, many gigs that didn't have that happen.
Yeah, it's magical.
Yeah.
You really get a sense that you're all in this together.
Yeah.
And it really changes the playing style. You know, even like playing on a, even with a sound system, I find that I would play very different on acoustic piano versus a keyboard.
Yeah.
Just like that in-tuneness it has and that plasticness of the sound.
Right.
There's just no substitute for like a slightly wet-tuned piano.
Right.
It has
just
a crunch.
Feels very real.
Yeah. Like when I first started learning piano, I took Mary Kay Brass's piano course at Pinewoods.
Uh-huh.
And she was talking how she often puts seconds in her chords, like close seconds, just because she wants a chord to have a little bit of crunch to it.
Sure.
And I find myself wanting that gritty feeling in a keyboard, you know, that you can't get.
In an electric keyboard.
Yeah, on an electric keyboard, because, you know, it's always in perfect tune. And you want to play pretty things or delicate things or textures or subtle things.
Right.
But when there's no sound system, or if you're playing an ancient out-of-tune piano where all the action is different on every key and some of the notes don't work, it's not about subtlety.
I wonder if they could make a keyboard that has those qualities.
Oh, my God. I have wanted that.
That would be so funny. Or if there could be different settings for different kinds of out-of-tuneness.
Yeah, like ragtime saloon out-of-tuneness versus, you know, contra dance piano out-of-tuneness.
Sitting in a Grange Hall for 30 years out-of-tuneness.
Right.
Right.
Or then there's like these, there are a few beautiful pianos, like the one on the stage at Glen Echo. That's a concert grand.
Oh, my
gosh. Tuned regularly.
That thing is amazing. Yeah.
And so there's a wide variety of pianos. It's an interesting job that we have as pianists that other people don't. Like, where you often don't end up playing your own instrument and you have to adapt to whatever's there.
Right, right.
I remember I played the Gilmanton Dance in New Hampshire, and I hope I'm not conflating these stories, but after a while, it doesn't matter if it's accurate because it's just part of the lore.
Yeah, it's true. Part of your experience somewhere in the past at some place.
I remember playing their piano, and it was not in great tune. You know, they did a good job maintaining it, but how much budget do you have to tune your piano? Or do you care is the other thing. But I remember them saying something like, there's a hole in the floor in front of the piano, so don't put your foot through the floorboards.
Right.
And I don't remember if I had the story exactly right, but I just found all that so charming. It's just so wonderfully charming.
Totally.
Or the piano on stage at the Scout House for many, many years, maintained by, you know, Kate Barnes and Debbie Knight and Jack O'Connor and all those folks. And they had the rearview mirror on it.
Oh,
so that you could see the dancers behind you.
Yep.
Classic.
So good. Another boon sometimes for playing the piano. I mean, it kind of is a double-edged sword because in these days of keyboards, we're either, you know, lugging a lot of equipment and heavy keyboards around, or we don't have to bring anything.
Right.
I had this one memory of playing for this dance with Randy Miller over in New Hampshire, and I got lost on the way to the gig. I thought I knew where I was going, and I took a wrong turn. And anyway, it was a little bit of an adventure getting there, but I finally ended up getting there like when it was supposed to start, or maybe even like 3 minutes after when it was supposed to start.
Mm-hmm.
But so I like walked in and I sat down and we basically started playing.
Yep.
You know, it was in that instance just amazing to be like, all right, I'm as like, we need to start right now and I can just sit down and play.
Don't have to tune.
There's nothing I can do.
Right.
We may have to tune, but that's not going to happen.
Right, exactly. For a while, I used to carry around a tuning wrench with me, a piano tuning wrench, just to fix unisons that were out of tune with each other, just a little bit with permission.
That's awesome.
But I think that's something that's changing. I think there are fewer and fewer pianos in the dance world, you know?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of times halls are deciding to get rid of them, or at the Concord Scout House, a lot of piano players don't even use a piano that's there.
Right.
They'd rather bring a keyboard.
I've played there quite a number of times recently, and I haven't, well, recently in quotes, it's been a while now, but
right.
But I haven't played the piano there
yeah
anytime in my memory.
Yeah, and honestly, I stopped playing it, not because it was a bad piano. They take great care of it, but because it was a little harder on my hands.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work to play a piano with heavy action, and as the hall gets more humid with the dancers, the action gets stiffer and stiffer, as the night goes on, and my hands are killing me.
Definitely.
But there's also subtler reasons, like it's easier to be in tune with the other instruments on a keyboard.
Yeah.
It's easier to play arrangements that you've prepared if you know what the timbre is going to be like.
Right. A lot of folks I played with like it when I play keyboard better because I can set up so that I'm looking at them.
Exactly. You can make eye contact.
Which, you know, I definitely, like, as a collaborator, musical collaborator, it, like, is very logical. Makes yep. a lot of sense. But I'm always torn.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, there's exactly. a big, you know, with some bandmates, I, you know, we have this kind of running thing. Whenever there's a piano, I'm like, I'm going to play the piano. And they're like, no, you're not. And, you know, it's...
I mean, it makes the
occasionally
monitor
I
mix.
Win, but I would say most of the time I don't, and that's okay. But, you know.
Well, it's like, it is these little things like sight lines. Can you see? You're just right. physical proximity to people. And then totally. There's also, like, the monitor mix is easier for everybody to balance if there's not an acoustic piano. Otherwise, totally. The mandolin player has to crank up their monitor really loud so they can hear themselves over the piano, and, yep. you know. And so I think that's another sign of the change. Like, today's contra music is, it's more subtle, it's more textured, more arrangements. It requires yeah. sound systems.
Yep.
And you don't have to be able to see your bandmates if you're just plunking along to the awesome chords to, you know, March of St. Timothy.
Sure.
Why do right. you need careful eye contact for that?
Right.
You know, you can hear most of what, like when I used to play at the Scout House, I remember Cal Howard, who played bass for many, many years as Yankee Ingenuity and every uh-huh. other band that came through there. When I would play with him, he would sit in with us sometimes. I mean, sitting with us. I felt like I was sitting in with him. You sure. know, I was just so thrilled. He would watch my left hand on the piano and just follow me.
Right.
I didn't have to talk to him. It was amazing.
Right.
But I'm also not doing fancy things. You know, I'm not doing things outside of what he would expect to find.
Right.
And that's a real sweet spot.
Yeah, it's one of those things. There's no, you know, all, everything has to evolve. And you know, I think that there's great, great value to, you know, both ends of that spectrum and in between. You know, I hope that as things evolve, as a community, we continue to, you know, look at those older tradition, older styles as well, and like, you know, borrow and use those things. And I think that like, you know, stealing from the past and while at the same time creating new things is like, I don't know, as good of a definition of a living tradition as I can kind of come up with for myself. So mm-hmm.
What are some of these new things?
I don't know, like I mean, I think as you were saying, like having bands like be more higher, like, levels of arranging and textured, as you were saying, having, you know, different instrumentation, different, you know, incorporating different types of rhythmic grooves, and you know, a lot of things like that. When I think of you know, a lot of more modern country dance music, which is really awesome, and I don't know, I think that a living tradition evolves and also is like always borrowing from from whence it has come.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is happening too, in the wider community.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
And I noticed.
I hope it continues that way.
Yeah. Right, and what are the factors that decide if it will or not?
Right.
You know?
People. I think it's us.
Woo, you solved it.
And everyone listening.
Because it's interesting. It's like these varying things of like what do communities want and need.
Totally.
Like some people go to a dance because it is their community. Other people do it as like entertainment.
Totally.
An activity to do.
Right.
And then there's what do callers want. And then there's what do dancers want. And then sometimes callers and musicians have to do what dancers want or else they don't come to the dances.
Right. It's all so multi-dimensional.
Some people like the slower tempos and the groovier feel and the happier vibe. And some people like intensity and excitement. And,
right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's all good. I mean, because it's all, I mean, I think when it comes down to it, as I said before, like, I think that at its best, contra dancing and social dancing more generally, like, should serve as a way to bring people together and build relationships amongst people.
Yeah.
And it's the people who are doing it who are getting that benefit. And so if it can benefit the people, then on all sides of the equation, then it's being successful, I think.
Yeah, like you mentioned before,
I think just to finish that thought.
Oh, please.
I think I think we can learn from like past, because like obviously these things have survived to a large, you know, they've survived through some number of years, and in some form, and that is a testament to the fact that it has like, through some through line through time, built a community. Or like there has been community built around those things, and so as we move forward, we can learn lessons about community building from that through line from the past, as well as adapting it to serve the needs of the current community.
Mm-hmm. And different communities have different needs.
Have different needs, right?
Right. Yeah, you were talking earlier.
And,
I think
it's also neat because then, like, contra dancing has different, like, you go to Portland, Maine, and it feels very different than, like, going to somewhere else. I don't know. Portland, they stomp their feet a lot, and it's excellent. But it's
they're joyful dancers.
It's a lot more. It's a lot more foot stamping than other places, and it's great. But right. Different. It looks different in different places.
Yeah, absolutely.
As it should.
I mean, there's a lot
of different
ways.
Sorry, you were going for it.
Oh, no, I was just talking about what you said before. So what you say now is even greater. That's great. We can talk about current Arthur and not past Arthur. But I was just going to circle back to something else you said before when you were talking about, like, the high schoolers who came up and whether or not they were executing the dance well.
Mm.
And I was like, there's just a lot of different ways you could think about executing a dance well.
Oh, sure.
And to me, are you having fun with each other and taking good care of each other? That, to me, is executing the dance well.
And in that case, those kids were picture
nailing
perfect.
Nailing it, right? Like, is it really about the moves and getting there on time? The moves in contra dancing are not that exciting, right?
Like, when it comes down to it.
Woo, circle! You know, like, that's kind of not the point.
Circle left, circle right.
And watching groups, like, I love playing for people who don't know how to dance,
mm-hmm.
but are very enthusiastic about learning
yeah.
and care to be there with each other. I think all those right. things have to happen. And like yeah. they're just doing Virginia Reel. They're doing Strip the Wheel all night.
Right.
And they don't care. And it doesn't matter if you're on time with the music or not. And, you know.
Well, it's funny you should say that particular example. Because so last summer I was in Scotland. And we were way up north in Scotland. And we were camping at this campground. And we saw a sign. Like just little... like printer paper sign for a Kaylee, and we're like, well, that's great, well, like, we should go. So we showed up, and it was like kind of the finale of this kind of camp for like local kids in the town, and there was actually some of the folks in the band were, I think, from some pretty well-known bands that I can't remember the name of now in Scotland. But the big hit of the night, for sure, we did it twice, in fact, which it was pretty, the dance was just Strip the Willow. So it started, you know, they started playing some high energy Scottish reels, and the top couple, you know, and we were, you know, we had no idea what was going on. There was very little calling that happened this evening, but so the top couple started swinging for about, you know, maybe an A part's worth, and then started stripping the willow down. And then when they got about four couples down, the next top couple swung for like about an A, mm-hmm. and then started stripping the willow down. And we did that, I would say, for about 20 minutes.
Wow.
Two times. And it was the most fun thing I've like ever done in my life. It was just like, it was like the thing to do right then. And it was... You know, I knew no one in that hall at all. And it was one of those moments. It was like the thing for the moment. And yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's magic. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that like one is better than the other. Wow, it's very exciting here. But like I've also been out at dances where the room is full of experienced dancers.
Yeah.
And the band is fired up and sounding amazing. The sound is perfect.
Yeah.
The caller's calling this really amazing dance with good flow. The dancers are all nailing the choreography and everyone is moving together like a machine doesn't, it's like a human, like they're moving together
yeah.
in harmony effortlessly.
Yeah.
That's also transcendent.
Totally.
In a different way.
In a totally different way, but just as transcendent.
Just as transcendent. And that's a different way of building community. You know, there's sometimes when you talk to your partner or your neighbor while you're dancing and build community that way. There's other times when you kind of build community just by all being together.
And doing the same thing in really...
In really good time.
Really good time with each other.
Yeah.
And you can like know that the next person is going to be right there at the same moment that you are. And then they're, you know, yeah.
Right.
For sure.
So I think the magic is for any of these forms of contra dancing is keeping the spirit of community and joy and yeah. all of it. Wherever you get your joy from and whatever your community is like. Yeah. I mean, I feel one of the reasons I wanted to start this project is because I feel like there isn't as much contra piano as there used to be. And there isn't as much boom chuck contra piano as there used to be. And so I just wanted to explore why people play the tunes they do and the choices they make. And, you know, what do people want without answering, like, what's right or wrong or anything
sure.
like that.
Yeah.
So do you have any thoughts? I know that's a big question to ask you, to like dump on you, but do you have any thoughts about that?
State it one more time.
On like contra piano is an instrument and boom chuck piano and seeing less of it in our dance halls now than there
sure.
used to be.
Well, yeah, I think that, I mean, as I said, I think that, it's obviously, I mean, for me, it's something, it's a style that I really enjoy the sound of and the energy of. I think that sometimes I hear the word dorky, which I take in the in, I love the word dorky.
Yes, it's an honorific.
Yes, for sure.
If I talk about dorky tunes. But, you know, I was talking to not to interrupt you, but talking to Jan, and he was talking about Quebec tunes, and they call them glorious tunes, the old style tunes just want to sing along to. And that's such a good word.
Glorious
tunes.
Oh, that's excellent. But I think that you know, as I was saying, I think that there's a lot of like evolution, which is necessary, but I think that with piano in particular, I think that it has an energy that it brings and a kind of driving force in like under everything else in the band. Kind of presence that is really it's hard to achieve with a lot of other instruments. And I also think that with, you know, going back to the conversation of real, you know, having like real pianos, when there's a real piano in the hall, there's something about the fact that it's kind of like a part of the building to me that makes the connection between the music and the space, I don't know, like feel different than playing a keyboard. And that's not necessarily a style thing, but I think that maybe besides an association that, maybe also going back to the conversation of, you know, beyond when there weren't sound systems and needing to project sound so that everyone can hear in the hall. I think that there's important lessons to be learned from that kind of from those thinking about those kind of connections between the space where you are and the people inhabiting that space, and how you can connect all those pieces. That I think I don't know, to me, from, you know, my perspective as a piano player, I think that it can be a big part of bridging that, you know, creating that kind of space in the music.
Yeah, I mean, some of my favorite experiences are playing at Pinewoods Camp, because they always have acoustic pianos there.
Yeah.
And in the main dance hall in C sharp, it's almost acoustic. It's like one of the closest things we get these days to doing it acoustic. Like when I run sound at Pinewoods, I try to just use it to amplify the instruments just enough so that everybody can hear it.
Right.
But so that it's almost transparent. You can't tell where the instrument stops and the sound begins. You know? And having that acoustic piano there changes the whole feel. It's something about the wood of the piano and the wood of the floorboards that people are dancing on and the rafters overhead and how that affects the sound and the feel. I don't know. It's hard to put into words.
It is hard to put into words. And I think in terms of the like stylistic part of your question, in terms of piano style, I think that in some ways what it comes down to me too, for me, is like that style of like accompanying the melody player and pulling the melody player out front, and having the melody of the tune, you know, be almost like a song. That's like, that's the kind of the thing. The piano is creating this rhythmic drive behind that, but just, you know, kind of supporting the melody and not kind of having its own thing be you know, kind of a thing for the sake of itself.
Right.
I don't know. I think that that's like not necessarily the way it should be all the time, but I think that it's a the intricacies of tunes are so cool, and the way that different people bring out tunes is so unique, and I love the hearing musical presentations that really bring that feature that aspect.
Mm-hmm. The feature of the tune front and center.
Feature the tune front and center.
And supporting the tune, whatever it needs or wants to be right. Supported.
And often that's a kind of a, you know, a boom chuck kind of piano style. It could be something else. I think it's a great part of the mosaic of contra dance music.
Yeah.
That I think is something that I'd love to continue to see out in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's lots of different ways to do it, and that's what makes it fun, is all this wonderful diversity that we have.
Totally.
But I think there's some parts that are worth making sure we hang on to.
Yeah, totally.
Because we could sort of just lose them by accident if we're not careful.
And I think that's a good point, because I think it's not necessarily... Like, it's like a choice to, like, for any, like, to play, I don't know, it's all choices about how we play, and so, yeah, I think it'd be easy to have that happen without thinking about it too much.
Yeah.
Or, you know, losing the same way we lose, you know, we lose skills that we, as a community, as a society, stop doing on a broad scale. I think, from time to time we see waves of people thinking, oh, like, we've lost this skill as a society. We should go back and not forget that skill or that piece of knowledge. And I don't know, boom chuck piano is probably pretty mundane, small, insignificant example of that, but hey, so I think it's not a bad one to not forget.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative, right?
Right, it's all relative.
But for the small laser beam scope of this podcast, I think it's a good thing to talk about.
Right.
And, you know, it's like a tradition, like, there is no overarching contra tradition, really. What there is a series of many small decisions made by many dance communities around the country.
Totally, yeah.
That then add up to these trends, but they're not all conscious. You know, like, people aren't saying, we're going to stop using acoustic pianos and switch to keyboards. It's just more like maybe town halls don't have pianos in them anymore, or maybe the people who played the pianos are more into guitar or keyboards now and they don't maintain the pianos, or, you know, generational changes.
Totally.
Value changes, the advent of sound systems and how that changes the need for a piano, all these things. That how guitar is more of a common solo rhythm instrument than it used to be.
Sure, right.
It's the only rhythm instrument. And all these little changes, and then all of a sudden a thing happens. And then the people who play boom check piano are older, and maybe the new people hear it and do it, or don't hear it and don't do it. Like, if a tradition is passed on through learning and doing, right. But if you come up in a tradition, you don't hear this anymore. How are you going to know how great it is?
Totally. Yeah, for sure.
Thank you, Arthur, so much for your time. So fun
Thank
to talk
so
to
much,
you.
Thank you so much, Julie. This is such a fun project, and I can't wait to hear all of the different voices.
Yeah. Till next time.
Till next time.
Thanks for listening to Contra Pulse. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit contrapulse.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!